welcome to the Triple Feature Podcast with me, Jillian Reck, and my co-host Stephen Dendy and Pedro Vargas. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
This is episode 4, where we have taken a little bit of a different theme today. We each chose one movie that the other two have never seen that we thought that they would enjoy. So didn't matter what genre, didn't have really any theme to connect the movies, just something we thought the others would enjoy. So, Pedro chose Punch Drunk Love, I chose Casablanca, and Steven chose The Usual Suspects. And I think we're going to start with Punch Drunk Love, with Pedro's choice. So, Pedro, talk a little bit about why you chose this movie, and we'll go from there.
Well, it's a movie I remember seeing with my sister. Like, it really stuck with me. I love it. And I figured it was a movie that maybe, hopefully, you guys would enjoy. Like, it's not your typical Hollywood movie. It is a romance, but it's a very stylistic romance from the director's, like, the director, Paul Thomas Anderson. He's very well known to have his own specific style, so his style is really all over that movie. And the way he just, you know, he tells this specific story, it's not your typical Hollywood romance type movie. There's so much in it. There's, you know, a little bit of action, lots of drama. You know, I like its weirdness. I mean, it really, like, I could see this movie, like, lots of times and not get tired. Like, it's just one of those movies where it's the style and how it stands out. Like, it really just interested me. And it still does. Like, I really, really love that movie.
Okay.
And well, you know, what did you guys think? You know,
like, I'm going to be completely honest with you. I hated every minute of it.
Okay. The thing is, knowing you guys, though. Okay, well, yeah, keep going.
Yeah, I get that it was an artsy movie, and I get that it wasn't supposed to be conventional, and it definitely wasn't, but I just didn't connect with any of the characters. I thought Adam Sandler was a really weird choice. I kept looking at the female protagonist, the love interest, thinking, why in the world are you interested in this man? Run away now. The entire movie, just I could not understand why anyone was the way they were. I just couldn't connect with the characters, and I guess my personal taste is character-based stuff. I have to be interested in the people and what's going on, and, you know, I completely respect loving movies for their style and their artistic creativity and that kind of thing, and I tend to not enjoy movies for that aspect. I can definitely appreciate the artistic parts of the movie. I get what they were going for artistically, and I understood that, you know, like, some of the shots were really cool, some of the, I don't know, I wouldn't call them effects, but you know, there was some interesting lighting and use of color, and I thought that was really cool. But as far as the characters the plot, I just could not get into it. I could not really enjoy it that much.
This, if I may,
this is
how I interpreted it. I feel like we're sort of in that perspective of the main character, who's Adam Sandler. And he's, you know, he's a socially awkward person. And I think in a way, the director sort of to sort of put the audience in his perspective, sort of like, you know, seeing not necessarily a point of view, but just sort of like it's like we're taking his personality and who he is, and it's sort of like that's what the movie's representing, like who he is, and that's why it has that weird sort of awkward feel, like with the music, you can feel it in the music, and in these certain weird pauses, like I feel like we're in that perspective of that character.
That's fair. Steven, were you about to say something?
No, but I can.
Oh, okay.
I certainly did not hate it like Jill does. You know, I do enjoy, you know, the artsy films. You know, I enjoy Wes Anderson's movies like The Royal Tenenbaums and all that. My biggest issue was that I am the kind of person that gets awkward or gets uncomfortable during awkward scenes in movies. You know, whenever there's like an awkward situation between characters, you know, I feel that awkward tension and it makes me uncomfortable. And for me, this entire movie was one big awkward
pause
scene. One big awkward pause, one big awkward scene, and I've never felt that before. I've never felt uncomfortable throughout an entire movie, and you know, it's weird.
Yeah, I feel like
I do agree with you, Peter. Like he was trying to do that on purpose, and you know, he was trying to portray, you know, trying to make the audience feel Adam Sandler's social awkwardness, and I weirdly enough, I don't, you know, I can't really fathom the other character in the movie, but I do identify with Adam Sandler's character. I can, you know, I actually sympathize with him. I mean, you know, because he is socially awkward, and I know what that's like. And he also felt like a character who was trying to search for what he wanted in life, but didn't know what it was, and found himself being imposed by those around him. Of his sister trying to set him up, and you know, they were like trying to control his life, trying to direct his life, and you know, he didn't want that, but he didn't know what he wanted for himself yet. And, you know, and I can identify with that. So I actually identified with his character, so I was already connected with him. But then on top of that, the awkwardness feel that he was going for just sort of,
it
was throwing me off and pushing me away from it. So it was an interesting movie, but it's also hard for me to watch just because, you know, it was hard for me to sit through.
I don't know the origins of the movie, but I feel like it might have been it might have been a movie that would be better off as a short film. I feel like there wasn't enough plot, and they were stretching it to fit an hour's.
I can see that. It barely felt like I had a plot to begin. It felt like a random set of events that just.
I mean, the first scene is
occurred for no reason.
Yeah, I mean, the first scene alone is more than 10 minutes of just him in a room.
Yeah,
and I don't know,
this director, yeah.
And I sat through a lot of student films that were very artsy and very abstract, and I never really appreciate that kind of movie. I completely, you know, respect it as an art form. I respect that that's the way that a lot of people enjoy making movies and watching movies. I tend to not enjoy things that are, I don't know how to put it. I don't want to insult movies like this because I get that there's a reason that they're doing it that way. But at the same time, it's like, I don't want to have to work to understand what you're trying to tell me in your movie. You know what I mean? And this one just kind of kept it out of reach for me. Like, I kind of sympathized with the main character, but at the same time, he was just unlikable to me. And I think maybe it's just, I just couldn't see Adam Sandler in the role. I don't know. I don't know if that had anything to do with it.
I actually liked Sandler's portrayal of it. Sandler has always been sort of a like that. I've seen, you know, in at least in his way he betrays his characters, have always been sort of socially awkward like that. So I think, you know, at least for me, you know, it felt like a natural fit for Sandler.
Yeah.
It was really all the other characters I just could not get behind. It just felt like, you know, I mean, I don't enjoy a lot of artsy movies myself, but that's just because for me, they usually, I can enjoy when they do right, when you get it right, but for me, usually a lot of movies don't get it right, at least for me. But when they do get right, you know, I do enjoy them. But for me, I just didn't understand why any of the other characters did what they did.
I didn't understand why the sister was a bitch.
It felt like there was no reason for anything that happened in this movie to have happened. I mean, at least in the weirdness of like the Wes Anderson movies, you know, it feels like there's a reason for it. You know, but in this, it is like, you know, like the antagonist, the sex hotline sending the brothers to come collect the money for, and all they got was $500. And like, but they traveled for so far, and there's no reason for them to come all the way down just for the little money.
Well, I mean, there's a little payback.
It just felt like, I don't know.
Well, I mean, obviously I don't know those four blonde guys that, you know, mugged him. Well, they didn't, you know, it's not like they explained anything about him. But they did seem like they weren't really well-educated. And you know,
well, no.
I think what Steven's getting at is
they were higher hands, so they were, you know, it didn't really matter. But they were only being paid. They like their boss was only paying them $100 to come down here to steal from this guy and beat him up or whatever. And they're traveling so far. I mean, there's like no.
I think they were just trying to take advantage of Adam Sandler's character. I mean,
I think what Steven's getting at is that there was no stakes to anything that happened. I mean, the big finale of the movie is him driving all the way to Utah and having...
You have to understand this is psychology, though.
And having a yelling fight with Philip Seymour Hoffman.
You see, that, him driving all the way to Utah, that was justified because he had a reason.
Yes, but even then...
But them coming from Utah, I felt there was no justification for that.
I'll give you that. But even at the end of the movie,
there was no justification for just about almost anything in this movie.
But, I mean, after all that, I mean, you have this scam going. I assume the entire sex line business was a scam to begin with. You have this whole scam running, and one guy coming from Utah and having a screaming match with you in your store is enough to have you back off without anyone ever throwing a punch?
Yeah.
I mean, especially, I feel like the whole movie was leading up to this this whole fight, and all they do is scream in each other's faces and it's over.
Yeah.
It just felt completely stupid to me. And then she forgives him right away for leaving her in a hospital.
I feel like you have to be more understanding about it. I mean, it's like what would you do in his situation? I mean, like, why would you want to fight that guy? Oh, you're doing this for the love of your life. Like, you just, the only thing he did was just go there.
I respect
Sandler character for what he did in that scene. But if you're running a scam like this, you're going to let some guy that you're scamming walk into your store and scream in your face, and that, and you're going to let down after that? You're going to give up there?
I understand why Philip Seymour Hoffman's character is back there. I understand like what they were going for. You know, because, you know, Adam Sandler is... He drove all this way just to defend the love of his life, which, you know, is making him a little crazy, and you don't fuck around with crazy. But they already set up Philip Seymour Hoffman character to be sort of crazy himself. So there was no reason for him to back down from a crazy match when he himself was being portrayed as crazy.
He sent four goons with crowbars to crash this guy's car on purpose. If Adam Sandler hadn't been willing to fight, they probably would have bashed their heads in with those crowbars. They were coming for them. So for the stakes to go from, I'm going to get killed by a guy with a crowbar, to I'm going to walk into a mattress store and have a screaming match with a guy, and that's the end of the movie, the stakes just completely fell out of the bottom of the movie to me.
I mean, I feel like you have to look at it in a different way. I mean, you know, I didn't necessarily... Well, you know, you do expect a big ending, but I feel like that alone is the big ending. Why do you need a fight or like a physical brawl or whatever?
Because they've already put the stakes high when that car crash happened.
I felt it. I mean, in the end, I felt like that was like such a big finale to just him just wanting it to just stop. Like, he just comes there, he's like, you know, like, that, say that's that, and then that's
but
it.
Why
then I
wouldn't
go,
you get
then
the police involved?
That was completely his decision, you know, like.
Yeah, but I don't understand why.
I feel like that's a detail that doesn't matter to the entire story. You know what I mean?
Any normal person would immediately call the cops.
But he's not any normal person. You have to understand the psychology, the way he grew up, the way he had seven emotionally abusive sisters. You know what I mean? Like, there's so much to consider when it comes to this character.
The ending, I have no problem with the stakes that they, you know, how the movie ended regarding stakes. My issue was, it felt inconsistent with the portrayal that we were given. Because Philip Seymour Hoffman was being portrayed as maybe not as crazy, but also crazy in his own way. Because he himself was also having a yelling match on the phone just because Adam Sandler told him to F off.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, even in the beginning, when he was sending four goons to travel across states to, you know, just to get like, what, $500? And they were only being paid $100.
Well, the thing is, they didn't know that they were going to get $500. He said that when he took out the money, that's all he could take out.
Yeah,
$500.
But still, you know, you saw that he was being like a conservative with the money. Like, he said that I'm only paying you $100, and all the expenses are yours. So they're already getting gypped anyway, and I don't know, it just felt like they portrayed, they give you an expectation of Hoffman's character, and then they completely undercut it, or went inconsistent with it at the very end.
And even then, you know, like, you start out, this woman's, you know, they have his social security number, they have his credit card number, they have his name, they have his address, they have his phone number. So they immediately set this up as, this is big stakes, they could take everything. And it's immediately cut down to, oh, well, you need to give me $700.
But he's once he fell in love with that girl, like, it felt like nothing else mattered. Like, he
But I'm not talking about, I'm not talking about Adam Sandler at this point, though. I'm talking about the scam.
It's the other characters that are
the
not
scam.
Really.
Oh. Yeah, it's the scam that's inconsistent. It starts out, they have everything they need from him to take over his entire life, and all they do with it is first ask for $700.
I don't know. I mean,
and then it goes
down
to $500, and then it's just a screaming match. I mean, they started out like they could take over this guy's entire life, and it slowly just goes down and down and down the entire movie to the point where it ends in a screaming match. And it just
they still have his social security in there. They still have all his information. There is no reason at all for him to back down.
Right.
I think that was there so that towards the end, once he confronts him, he doesn't necessarily confront him about those details.
Which he should have.
I know. And trust me, I'm so with you. Like, I would, if I were him, I'd be like, dude, I'm gonna fucking call
I would have called the police immediately.
Exactly. That's the thing. But that's us.
And then the friggin' pudding thing. What the fuck was that about?
That was for the frequent flyer miles thing.
I know. He told us about 500 times, but I still don't understand. That didn't go anywhere.
Well, no. See, that was sort of just a play off, you know, the show Adam Sandler's character that he's quirky. He doesn't sing like regular people.
Yeah, I think they just spent way too much time on it, though.
I will agree with. They spent too much time on unnecessary, like if they wanted that payoff.
It's like, how much money did Healthy Choice pay these people to put their name in this movie for 25 minutes of this hour and a half movie?
It just felt like this movie gave us too much unnecessary stuff.
That's why I said it felt like a short film.
Yeah. The thing is, I see it as like a film noir. We're sort of following this character along with all these things that are happening with him. And I feel like those kinds of things are necessary to, like, you know, I know that they've like stretched that out, that weird quirkiness with whatever. But I feel like it was necessary because it's like we're following him.
But they didn't, but you know, they could have expanded it onto other things. They didn't have to keep focusing.
It still has
on
to go
one.
Somewhere. Like, I understand quirky
But it did.
It's you know, it does, to me it has a story.
No, the pudding thing.
I don't necessarily agree. It has to go somewhere as long as it's fuel for the character's development. But if you're going to spend that long
on a subplot, it should at least have some kind of payoff.
See, I don't really see that as a thing as a subplot. It's more of like character development thing, whatever. Subplot.
I mean, they explain the pudding thing like 4 times in the movie, and the pudding doesn't even come into it in the end. It doesn't. He still has to wait. So he has to pay for his own ticket to the plane anyway. So it's like, okay.
That was just something that was part of him, of his personality, you know. I mean, I know it didn't really go anywhere, I know. But, you know, I felt like it was one of those things that was necessary to really let you know who this person is psychologically. I know that maybe they did you know, stretch it out for like a lot.
At the end, you know, I got what they were trying to go for. I just don't agree that they achieved it.
I'll give you that.
I just don't think it was as successful as it could have been. I mean, it could have been way more done.
Maybe can you get into that a little bit?
Well, you know, just what we're talking about, you know, the inconsistencies of the character portrayals.
Do you mean it could have been more successful in getting its point across?
Yeah. Like, I agree. Like, the screaming match could have worked. You know, the way they ended it could have worked. It just didn't feel consistent with the characters that we were given. It just felt like right there immediately at that one point. We get a 180 change.
I mean, a lot of it with what the Philip Seymour Hoffman was doing, it was just trying to scare him too, you know. I mean, obviously this is like some sketchy, cheap.
Yeah, but I was saying that they could have found a better way to do it to make the payoff work that they were wanting to go for.
Mm-hmm.
Cause they can still mess up his lives. They can still. You know, they're. I mean, just from the way that Philip Seymour Hoffman portrayed the character, there was no reason for him to, character wise, to back down.
They could have given Adam Sandler some bigger stakes. You know, empty his bank account, do something, or you know, talking to the writers now, do something. So that Barry is...
You listen to
Radis? Yeah. Well, I'm talking from a writing standpoint. You know, do something so that Barry is completely on his knees so that he has to act.
Now that I'm thinking about it, boy, and I'm not saying to ignore this part, but when it came to Philip Seymour Hoffman and Adam Sandler, I felt like that was a big part of the story in the movie, but the real main thing was pretty much him and the girl, right? I mean, I felt like that was...
The girl becomes his big motivation in standing up to them, but at the same time, and I get he wanted to protect her and everything. I get all that.
Yeah.
But... I just don't buy Philip Seymour Hoffman and the goons as a big threat. I don't see them as a big, you know, like they started out as a bigger threat than they ended up being. And I think that's why throughout the movie, it just keeps dropping in importance to the point where it's like, okay, at this point, he knows the address, send the cops there. You know what I mean? It just doesn't make sense to me why... Going there and screaming in his face is
worth it. See, that I actually think, you know, Adam Sandler's character in that moment made sense to me because I feel like he would do something like that. And, you know, I was actually like the screaming match and, or not the screaming match, but the screaming finale part, you know, mm-hmm. you know, where he's walking out. And,
this ends, yeah.
Yeah, that part, I you know, him going to Utah, that part I agree with. Him finally getting out and beating those guys, you know, those two were the big moments. Or the only two moments in the film that I actually enjoyed and was like, yes, finally something. I think those were consistent with this character. You know, a character like that would just become so angry that he would have to get out there and do it himself.
Right.
So Adam Sandler's character I can get behind. It's the other characters that I just couldn't get a feel for. And oh my God, it's his sister, a bitch.
His sisters are bitches.
I couldn't figure out why that was happening. You know, she was a bitch.
I get having a bitchy sister, but it felt like she was like for no reason, like unwarranted bitchiness on her part.
I guess it's just one of those things where like that's just how they grew up. You know, like she, like maybe it, you know.
But that wasn't really established. They established that the sisters were naggy.
But they didn't really establish
that they were abusive.
Is that like the other sisters? You know, when they were ragging.
But they kind of do. And when he goes to that party,
At the party, they establish that, you know, that they rag on them. Sibling, you know, there's some sibling, what do you call it?
Rivalry,
I guess. You know, there's like siblings too. They rag on each other.
Didn't seem that horrible in the beginning.
It was bad, but it wasn't like, oh my God, I want to punch you in the face, bad.
Right.
But for some reason, they took the one sister and they just like turned her up to 11, and they didn't really give us a reason.
Had started with that, then I would have been much quicker to get on board with why Barry is the way he is. But instead, you see this, you know, family of, yes, annoying and naggy sisters, but nothing too out of the ordinary, and this guy that's just completely off the rails. Whereas if they had started with, this is why this guy is the way he is, now let's watch him overcome that, I think I would have been on board a little bit more. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and they do care about him. They do, I mean, well, that one weird, naggy, bitchy sister, she does care about him.
Yeah.
She looked for a girlfriend for him and everything. I mean, not in, you know, she you know.
But at the same time, she puts him down in front of her. Like, I didn't understand. Like, are you trying to help him?
They're corrupted family. Like, you know, like, I don't know, something mentally is wrong with that family. I mean, that's why that guy's messed up. There's something wrong with something. They have a history, obviously. You know, I don't know. They're all messed up in the head, you know. And you know, just affected him growing up as a kid, you know. Yeah. Up until as an adult. I don't know. I mean, and you guys say it's an artsy movie. I don't see it as an artsy movie. The thing is, I already know this director. I don't know if you guys have you guys seen Boogie Nights or, There Will Be Blood?
No.
I don't know if you guys.
I've seen There Will Be Blood, and that's a good movie.
Yeah, like that's like that. He just has that specific style. Like that's.
This feels like a completely different style than from where There Will Be Blood.
Well, it would be. I haven't seen it, but
it's very good. But I mean, you know, I think he's just one of those directors that likes to experiment, trying new things.
And I get that, and you know, and I applaud him for that. And when it works, like in There Will Be Blood, it worked. It just for me, it just didn't feel like it worked. Like I know what he was going for, and I could see where, and I wanted him to get there. It just, for me, it just didn't feel like it got there.
I didn't feel any romantic tension or chemistry at all.
I did when they were in the hotel room and they were, like, talking about, like...
That just made me want to take a shower.
I mean, it was, you know, it's kind of cute.
I didn't feel anything between them. I thought it was really awkward and just...
Yeah, I got his feelings. I got his feelings for her.
Yeah, I didn't get why she liked him at all. I couldn't
get her feelings for him.
Well, I mean, maybe it was because she probably knew that guy might have needed help. And maybe she wanted to find love, and she figured, you know, I find this guy cute, and he's probably messed up because I know his one sister already.
They didn't give us any of that in the film, I felt. No. They didn't really give us anything.
Oh, no, they didn't. But I think that's something that you know.
First of all, you get asked to leave a restaurant and you don't bat an eye. You've never been with this guy before. You don't know who this guy is from Adam. You get asked to leave a restaurant and you're perfectly fine with that.
Well, no, see, what I got is that, like, you know, she was playing it down because when he came back, it obviously looked like she and everyone else could hear him in there. And so she knew why they were going, and she didn't want to
embarrass him. Right, but you stay with him after that? I would have gotten out of there so fast.
That I'd agree with. I understand what she was doing. I just didn't understand the why she was doing it.
Yeah.
And that's what I never got from her, was the why.
Well, I mean, obviously there was she felt like a connection was there with him.
Yeah, she felt that, but
we didn't feel
why.
That. I didn't feel
like I understood why it was there for him.
Well, I felt it. I just didn't understand why it was there for her. I felt it because she felt it.
Yeah, but just because the director says she feels it doesn't mean that the chemistry is just going to automatically be there. I didn't feel any kind of spark.
I didn't feel like it was forced. I really felt like there was a connection that she wanted to make with him.
I just got a real creeper vibe. I don't know. I did not enjoy him at all, and her liking him just made it more uncomfortable for me, honestly.
Just the way the movie's played out. Generally, it's not. You gotta also consider that this is not your typical beginning, middle, and end type Hollywood movie.
I don't think you can use that as an excuse, because there's a lot of not typical movies out there.
Yeah,
but
this director specifically, the way he makes his movies,
I'm the kind of person that says, or that thinks that you can't really hide behind. This doesn't work, but this is my style, so therefore it works. Like, you know, you can have different styles, and different styles can work, but just saying, oh, that's my style, doesn't really mean that it works.
Right.
It's, you know, I mean, I don't know. I really enjoyed it. I felt like everything in the movie made sense, from how it was shot to each character's agenda with each other and with the story itself.
I get this movie an A for effort for what it was going for, but as far as execution, I gotta say I gave it like a C minus.
I give this movie a P for pudding.
I don't know. I think it's because I know I've already seen his other movies. Maybe that's why I'm so comfortable with just how everything's played out. Like,
I think you're a lot more open than me, and possibly Steven. I can't speak for Steven, but I think you're a lot more open to an artsy or an open style than I am. And that's fine. That's great. I'm glad that you can enjoy movies like that. I wish I could as much as you guys do. But I tend to prefer movies where I see what I get. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think I'm a happy medium between the two. I do enjoy artsy films when they work, but for me, this one just didn't work for me.
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe we should move on, unless there's something else we'd like to say about Punch Drunk Love.
We probably could talk about this movie for hours.
We could probably talk about all of our movies for hours.
Yeah.
All right.
But yeah, Yeah, we can move on, I suppose.
So I chose Casablanca. I kind of had a little bit of a side agenda when I chose this movie, because Steven has said for quite a while that he tended to not enjoy black and white movies on the whole, and I'm convinced that it's because he hasn't seen the right ones. So I chose Casablanca because it's one of my favorites. I tend to enjoy classic movies, classic style of storytelling, a little bit of adventure, a little bit of romance, a little bit of history, and just all around good classic acting. So I've seen this movie a bunch of times. I own it. I love this movie. It's usually on lists of the best movies ever made, even though it's not, it's nothing as grand as, say, you know, Schindler's List, or, you know, some people say Citizen Kane is the best movie, which I don't really enjoy, but, you know, it's technically, it's not a perfect movie, but I still think it's a really good classic for a reason. So I guess let's talk about what you guys thought of it.
Well, that was the last movie I saw out of the three.
Okay.
And I liked it. I liked it. I really liked the story and the drama especially between Humphrey Bogart's and Ingrid Bergman's character, with the past that they've had, that they fell in love with in Paris. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, she reappears in his life again. You know, like that, the whole drama of it was pretty interesting. And visually, too, the use of black and white looked really nice, I thought. Yeah.
Cool. Steven?
I honestly don't know how I feel about this movie.
Well, talk it out.
Yeah.
If I had to say right now, I would have to say I'm pretty apathetic about it. Like, I didn't hate it, and it was actually fine to sit through. My issue with bad movies isn't, you know, that I don't like them. It's like just the way they're made, the way they're performed. It takes me out of the viewing experience for me, so that's why it's hard for me to watch. And this one, I could sit through just fine. I don't know. I just couldn't, and I can certainly see why people think it's a classic. But it just didn't move me in a particular way.
I gotta say that I somewhat felt the same way. I really did like the movie, but I seeing it, I really don't feel like what the big deal is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I think if you look at it from a historical standpoint, it was made in 1942 while World War II was still going on.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And
yeah.
they scheduled the release of the film to coincide with the Allies overtaking Casablanca
at that time.
The movie coming out was actually at the exact same time as the Allied forces in the actual war were overtaking Casablanca and taking it back from the Axis.
Huh.
So people seeing this movie already had a very strong emotional attachment and reaction to it because it was so ingrained in what was going on.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be the equivalent of, you know, a movie about a win in the Iraq war as it was going on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it would have been a big, you know, hurrah for us kind of thing. But at the same time, it's got this beautiful romance going on, and there's drama and there's excitement and there's a little bit of, I guess you'd call, espionage. But at the same time, I just think it's really cool that this movie that no one really thought anything was going to become of, no one had any big plans for it. It wasn't going to be Gone with the Wind. It wasn't going to be this big, grand thing. It was just another movie that one of these studios put out like they always did. kind of stood the test of time because of the great acting, the great writing. Like you said, the visuals work really well in black and white, even though that's all they had back then. Right. And I think the reason, like you said, you don't know the big deal, and this is speculation.
Well, I mean,
no, and that's a fair.
So I did consider, like, how must have been when this movie came out, and I assumed that it came out in the 40s, right? During the
war. 1942, and the war ended in 45, if I'm not mistaken.
Like that, I was considering that as watching, like what did people think, or like how did they sort of connect with this movie because of all that stuff that was happening at that time.
And I think back then, people were a lot more concerned with the World War than, let's say, we would be with the Iraq War now, both because of what we're shown and just because of the way society is now and back then. You know, war bonds and you know, doing your part for the war effort kind of thing was a daily, everyday occurrence for most Americans. So something involving, you know, somebody helping win the war wouldn't just be your everyday hero. It would be somebody to really, really look up to.
Another really interesting thing about Humphrey Bogart's character is that he didn't care which side he was on.
He didn't.
He
was a good guy in the guise of someone who didn't care because he had been burned.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Like you know, he cared what one side won, but he'd been so hurt that he just like didn't care anymore.
It's like he kept saying, "I stick my neck out for no one."
Yeah.
He cared that, you know, the Allies won, but he wasn't about to put his nose into it.
He didn't like what he was saying, but he didn't. But you know, he'd been so hurt that he was like, "Well, to hell with the world."
Yeah, the only thing he cared about at that point was her, even though he expected her to never show up again. So when we see him in the beginning of the movie, he keeps saying his line, "I stick my neck out for no one. I stick my neck out for no one," even though he may want the Allies to win. He's not about to ruffle any feathers because he has his business. He has his living. He expects to die in Casablanca. So So when she shows up, everything goes out the window because now he can't he can't keep up that facade of I don't care anymore because he does care.
Like that all changed when she came in.
Yeah. Right. And I'm a sucker for romance, and I really love the fact that they're. Other than, you know, the Axis powers, there really is no bad guy in this movie, except for the Germans. You know, like, Victor Laszlo, her husband, isn't a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, it's like he himself and the decisions he makes, he kind of made himself the bad guy.
Yeah, he can be seen as an anti-hero, but in the end, he redeems himself.
Yeah.
I think the reason why I'm so apathetic towards the movie because from a story standpoint, it feels like a paint by numbers story, which given in its time, it wasn't.
Explain.
Because cinema's new and still growing back then. But in terms of, you know, stories today, it feels very paint by numbers. And
what do you mean by that?
He's a guy who lost the love and now she's back and he has to deal with that. And It just felt like the story itself and the way it was portrayed, it felt so general, and there was nothing special about the story besides the setting he was in.
Can I suggest that that's because so many movies have stolen from Casablanca over the years?
I agree. And my point is, if I had seen this earlier in my life, I would probably have this. I would probably have the affinity for it that you do.
Right,
but I'm so much older now, and I've seen so many movies, so many stories, you know, that I've seen this story so many times that like this didn't feel like any different or any special, so it doesn't really stand out.
From
the technical standpoint, this is a really well made movie. It's probably one of the best older movies I've seen, technically speaking. And so I probably would have liked it had I seen it earlier, but I've just seen this, you know, because I'm coming at it such later in life, it just doesn't really stand out as anything to be held special, I guess. From a historical standpoint, in terms of movie history, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But just in terms of story and enjoyment, it just feels
bland.
Bland, general, basic.
And so. Yeah, exactly.
I feel like what I try to do usually is when I see an older movie, anywhere from the 40s to the 20s to the 70s, when I see a movie, I try to put myself in I try to put myself in the place of the audience of when it was released. And you know, what I was meant to be seeing. Like, one thing that stood out to me last night when I watched it, and I've seen it a bunch of times, but something that stood out to me last night was when Ingrid Bergman calls the piano player the boy playing the piano. Now, it's like a 50-year-old man or more, a black man, playing the piano. And
Sam.
Yeah, so back then, there was nothing wrong with calling a black man a boy. Now you get your face kicked in, you know. But you have to put yourself in the place of the audience of when it was put out. So
I agree to an extent, but I also don't think you can do that too much. I didn't really think about the time it was in. I didn't really think about, you know, the audience it was for, you know, like Pedro did. I would just come at it just from a pure story standpoint, pure, you know, sitting now looking at this story that's being told to me.
Mm-hmm.
And just from that, like y'all were talking about the history, yes, it's a great movie. And, you know, and from the time I was in, and I can certainly see why it's captured the hearts of so many people. But, you know, just from a story standpoint, you know, it just didn't grasp me from what I was shown, you know?
Yeah.
But it's certainly a well-made movie. And I can...
And even the kind of storytelling, like...
Maybe
back then, like, it would have been like, oh, wow, like, he let her go and he stayed?
I enjoyed the way that they told us, they unveiled his history through the flashbacks. You know, I thought that was cool. Technically, I thought it was really well done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was really good. Yeah.
And one thing that stood out to me, too, last night was the fact that she actually says, no, I don't know what to think. You have to do the thinking for both of us now. And I was just thinking about women in movies and how things have changed and not changed. From that point on in the movie, she gives up all decision-making. And she just kind of lets the men decide her fate. And for someone who was so... as we saw in the flashbacks, for someone who was so in charge of her own life, it seemed, and so kind of, maybe not carefree, but someone who had things together, you know, she had a good head on her shoulders. For someone to go from that to, well, I can't decide between these two men anymore, so they'll have to decide for me. It just, again, putting it in the perspective of when it was made, that was normal back then. But now, watching it for purely a story standpoint, that's going to seem weak to you. You know what I mean?
I think you could also take it like as that could be seen as, you know, as a trope of women in the time. But you could also take it as, you know, here is someone who is so in love with both these men, you know, to an equal degree that she, you know, she can't make a decision because, one, she loves both of them just about the same.
Yeah.
And no matter what she does, she's going to hurt someone that she loves.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not trying to take away from her decision or her predicament.
Right. Yeah.
But it was just an interesting thing to see, even back then, how it wasn't about the women, it was about the men.
And I definitely agree with you. I also think you could put a man in the same situation and justify him saying the same thing. But the fact
I don't know about that.
And for that time specifically?
It depended on the story. I mean, it may be harder. I can certainly grant you may be harder to do. But, you know, I'm the type of person that doesn't think that there's necessarily any story idea or storyline that can't be done correctly. But, you know, but it would definitely be harder to do.
Yeah.
And I can definitely see why it was, you know, that this, you know, type of thing was used, you know, a lot of the times for women back then in that time.
Right.
And it definitely hurt the portrayal of women back then.
Yeah. Well, again, that was the normal back then.
Yeah. You know? And I think that's why it hurts the portrayal of women, because it's such the norm.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that's for a lot of tropes that hurt women. It's not always because of what's being done to them, but the frequency and that's all that they give them.
Oh yeah, totally. It's about breaking not just stereotypes, but you know, things that we don't even think of as being bad because they're so normal.
Yeah, because or regular. You're so.
It's so ingrained in the culture.
It's so ingrained that it just passed through our filter.
Yeah.
And Sam, the piano player, they were friends. You know?
Oh yeah.
I don't know if that was, you know, it wasn't like, oh, I'll work for you and you're my boss. Like, it was more than that, you know. Like, that's another thing.
And when he was leaving, he was trying to give him a higher pay raise.
Mm-hmm.
It really felt like
right.
It really felt like the characters were treating him as an equal, which was probably not the norm of that time. Like, probably.
If you consider it that way. I mean, yeah, and everyone felt pretty equal, like Ingrid Bergman and how Humphrey Bogart treated her. Like, there was like a, you know, like an equal connection between them, you know. And with the piano player as well. So yeah, I mean, so many things to consider that we don't think of whatever now, but like back then it was a huge deal, you know.
Right.
So pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah. It's a very interesting movie historical wise and technical wise. Mm-hmm. I just felt pretty.
But like, I get what you mean, how it has sort of like a bland feel to it. Like, I liked it. I'm not going to say I loved it.
It's a decent film, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's watchable, and I really enjoy it. I really did.
And, you know, I can't say I would not mind watching it again. You know it's not a movie. Right. I would, you know, I'd say, hey, if you do you want to watch it, I'd be like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, sure, why not?
Cool.
Yeah.
Mission accomplished, then. I mean, I'm not trying to defend it, but the another reason it might have felt bland was they also had a different style of filmmaking back then. When
that's true,
they always felt like they had to have a musical number and some kind of entertainment. Which I think the music was beautifully blended into the movie.
Compared
to a lot of other movies back then, where the movie would just stop on a dime and there'd be music numbers and dance numbers, and then they would pick up the story again. This movie really did a really good job of blending the music into the story.
I felt like visuals and sound and music, I thought that was great. But like the story is the only thing that felt bland for me. But just because it's a story that...
It's a
very common thing that every other movie has copied from that we've already seen, so... Yeah.
I do agree with you. Like the director, the movie style, the directing style, whatever the way it was shot, that definitely does play into one of the reasons why, you know, older movies are hard for me to get into, just because you know it's such a weird way to tell a story. And you know, it was the norm back then, but for me, it just takes me out. But this one, like you said, it was very different. It blended in well, and it just. You know, it was very easy to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was.
It flowed very. It flows very well.
Flowed very well.
I feel like a lot of the majority of a lot of like those movies from that time, like a lot of them feel the same. Like you, like you wouldn't care who directed what. I mean, if it was Alfred Hitchcock, or
Hitchcock had a very distinct style, but he He also came later. Yeah. He was the 60s and the 70s.
He came more, like, his style came into light, like, in the 60s,
But if you look at, like, the Marx Brothers, every one of their movies has a very same formula. And their music numbers, while they're amazing, I'm a huge fan of the Marx Brothers. Even though their music numbers are amazing, they do just kind of stop the story. And that's because they came out of vaudeville, and that's what you did in vaudeville. It was acts. You know, you'd have a comedy act, and you'd have music. You'd have another comedy act. You'd have music, and that's what they were building from.
And it's because, you know, movies were so new, they didn't know how to translate from one medium. They're still learning. They're still figuring out, hey, how do I do this thing?
Most movies in, you know, the 20s, 30s, and 40s were basically plays on film.
Exactly, and that's one of the big things of why it's hard for me to watch.
And this movie, I'm not going to say it's the first. It's one of the first in a group of movies that started to take it into being its own art form. You know, with the special camera angles and you know, shadow shots and things like that.
Yeah.
One of my favorite bits of trivia about the movie is in the airport scene. Instead of use any kind of green screen, or which they didn't really use back then, but something similar to that. Instead of doing that in the airplane scene, they cut the front off of an airplane, put it in the background, and then to make it look like it was even farther away, they hired a crew of little people and put them in airport costumes and had them walk next to the plane so it looked like they were farther away.
Huh.
And that's how they did it in camera. And, you know, it was out of necessity, but that's brilliant.
Yeah.
And some of it were, like, little model planes, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And projections of when they were, like, out in the airport, you could see it was a projected screen of, planes taking off or whatever.
Yeah. But, I mean, that kind of stuff you wouldn't have seen in plays or vaudeville. I mean, that was the beginning of using in-camera effects.
Yeah.
Even though it was a small scene, it was a background, but it sold.
It does
the location of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very well technically done movie.
Yeah.
Even for its time, it was. You know,
exactly.
I mean, it even holds up to today, I think.
Oh yeah.
Exactly.
Cool. So that's Casablanca. Third film was The Usual Suspects, and before I turn it over to Steven, I will just say, if you have not seen The Usual Suspects,
spoiler alert,
there is an ending that we really do not want to spoil for you, and we will be talking about it. So if you have not seen The Usual Suspects, and you plan to, or you would like to, which we highly recommend, because I thought it was a fantastic movie.
It was pretty awesome.
Oscar award winning. I would turn off the podcast now, and we will say our goodbyes.
Just watch it. Don't watch it and come back. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, how are they going to know when to come back, though?
Well, pause the podcast. Well, go watch it. Come back. No, well,
that doesn't work.
We'll say 1, 2, 3, pause. And
then...
yeah, but that
they
okay.
Podcast has been around long enough. They know what to do.
Just don't listen to the rest of this if you plan on.
No,
watching The Usual Suspects and do not want it ruined for you. So, that being said, Steven, The Usual Suspects.
Okay, this is one of those movies that, you know, everyone has seen. The one that, you know, everyone always talks about, you know, it was just one of those films that was almost guaranteed that you've seen, that everyone has to watch. It's one of those movies that you have to watch at least once. And weirdly enough, this is one of the movies that I did not see until a couple of years ago. So I am just about as new to this movie as you guys are, which I was surprised that you guys hadn't seen it either. So I thought this was a perfect movie to do. But this was like almost like a classic film noir that just turned it on its head at the end. And it's one of those endings that everyone talks about, just, you know, like the head in the box in Seven, It's one of the movies that everyone always talks about.
Giving spoilers.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you haven't seen Seven, don't listen to this podcast. But,
yeah.
And luckily enough, you know, I'd always heard of Kevin Spacey and Kaiser Sose and all that, but I'd never, luckily, I'd never heard the twist, or if I had, I'd forgotten about it. And it just blew me away when that ending sequence comes. It was like mouth open, jaw on the floor. Mm-hmm. Just what just happened?
Yeah,
I envy you because I didn't feel. The thing is, I knew who Kaiser Soze was.
Yeah,
without having seen it, like I was curious. I think somebody mentioned. I think it was you, Stephen. You mentioned Kaiser Soze a while back. Or something, or and I'm like, oh, what's, you know, like that name I've heard about. I looked it up in Google, and then I just see Kevin Spacey's face as like images. I googled it.
You unintentionally.
And I'm thinking like, oh, okay, that's Kaiser Soze. I don't know what this movie's about.
This is why you don't Google things.
The thing is, I didn't know. I didn't know that movie had a twist.
I know, me neither. Actually, last night while I was watching it, I texted Steven and I said, who is Kaiser Soze? Because I thought Kaiser Soze was a real gangster in real life. And he said, are you asking me for spoilers? And I thought, well, no, I didn't think I was. Because I've heard Kaiser Soze so much in relation to gangsters that I thought he was an actual gangster.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, I am so glad that I was not ruined for this movie. I was ruined for The Sixth Sense. I knew, spoiler alert, I knew Bruce Willis was dead the whole time.
Yeah, spoiler alert.
That movie.
I remember when I was in middle school and some kids were blurting it out like in the hallways of my school. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, God damn it.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to see it and then Jesus.
I had the only good Shyamalama Ding Dong movie ruined for me.
It's not the only one. Unbreakable.
Unbreakable's really good, yeah. But still, good, but, that twist is one for the ages.
It is.
But anyway, back to The Usual Suspects.
Back to The Usual Suspects.
So yeah, even before we got to the twist, or even the middle of the movie, Kevin Spacey's acting stood out to me right away. Man. He is fantastic. Easy.
Mm-hmm.
Really amazing, yeah.
He is just on a whole other level. I thought the
so creepy.
Oh yeah.
I mean, knowing who he was,
mm-hmm. Going back,
right, yeah. Like thinking about it now, like you know, like the how great of a liar his character was, but mm-hmm. the way he pulled it off, you know,
and the crying. That's the thing. I completely believed the crying.
Yeah, and him being a cripple, like I believe he was a cripple, you know.
Oh,
this is probably one of the most successful unreliable narrator stories.
What are some others that you can think of?
Now that you put me on the spot, I can't think.
I'm having trouble thinking of any.
Yeah. They're not done that frequently,
right?
Yeah. I mean...
Unless it's like a he said, she said kind of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, overall, before I got to the twist, I felt it dragging because there was so much testosterone going on in this movie. It's a guy's movie for sure, but it's still very well done. There's a lot of just guys, you know... puffing themselves up like gorillas.
Yeah.
And shooting each other. But Baldwin there's some...
guy.
Oh, Stephen Baldwin, who
yes,
just Baldwin. Annoys the hell out of me. Kevin Pollak's okay.
Yeah.
Del Toro, yeah. I don't know what... Oh, drug, I don't know what drug what, Benicio
not
Del Toro
just, not, just Kevin, not just Kevin Spacey, but they got like a big cast. Like,
oh,
like,
yeah,
they got,
everyone
they
in
got
the
a
movie
young,
great.
A young Benicio Del Toro. We got Kevin Pollak. Mm-hmm. You got Stephen Baldwin, who was sort of big at the time, I guess.
Yeah, he was kind of a minor character in that.
The guy who played the Federal Agent Kujan, who was interviewing Spacey, he was pretty big.
The who? What now?
the guy who was playing the federal agent Kujan, who was
Meatface.
Yeah.
Meatface. he was actually a big grab for this movie when it
He's a good actor. I just always think of him as playing
when they showed the cast like in the credits in the beginning, those were very mafia.
Oh yeah.
Esque.
Every gangster who's actors. Ever been in a movie.
Oh yeah.
That's why I was saying in the beginning, where's Pesci, you know?
De Niro, at least.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, they were all offered or auditioned for the part, and they either walked away from it. They all walked away from it. I'm not sure about Pesci. I know De Niro, Pacino, Christopher Walken.
I feel, was probably supposed to be the Irish guy's character.
I think Pacino, who is he going to be? I think, I want to say he's going to be one of the agents, one of the cops, maybe.
Really?
Yeah. But he actually turned it down because he was going to do Heat.
Okay. Well, yeah, that was probably just as good.
That time in particular was a huge time of, like, mafia type movies, right?
Yeah. Goodfellas.
Goodfellas, yeah.
Yeah.
Heat. That movie, everybody, not just Kevin Spacey, they all did it.
Everyone was great in it. There wasn't a dull actor in the house, I guess.
The only thing was I didn't really feel the relationship between, I can't remember the character, but Gabriel Byrne's character.
Dean Keaton.
Dean Keaton.
I didn't really feel the relationship between him and the only woman in the movie.
I guess
she was there so that Kaiser Soze would threaten him to do the job.
She was in the movie, but I just didn't feel like
she wasn't really developed that much.
She was supposed to be this big bargaining chip, and I could definitely see his feelings for her, but
she was supposed to be like, you know, the reason for his turnaround from being a crooked cop, you know, now he's going legitimate, trying to establish some restaurant at the beginning of the movie. But yeah, she was supposed to be some, you know, this big turnaround for him, but you know, she is slightly underdeveloped.
She was a little cold. For a movie that had one woman in it, I feel like the one woman should have been at least a little bit
more fleshed out.
Fleshed out.
Yes.
That being said, it's a great movie. It wasn't about the women. It was about these guys.
It's about Kaiser Soze.
I just thought it was pretty damn well done.
Yep.
He was a scary character. The way they represented Kaiser Soze in the movie, he was really scary. Like, that story where, as a myth, like the way that whole story about his family, whatever.
That actually is based on a real life person.
Is it?
Oh God!
When Bryan Singer and Christopher McQuarrie, the one who wrote it, and Bryan Singer directed it. When they got together to do this film, the original premise was just five criminals get together in a lineup. That was that was the starting point of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And as he was writing it, he came back to a previous unsold script of his that he was working on about the biography of a man named John List, I believe his name was, who was a notorious murderer who killed his entire family and disappeared for like 20 years and wasn't captured until America's Most Wanted ran his story.
Mm-hmm.
But McCoy was just fascinated how this guy could just nonchalantly just kill his entire family and then just disappear. And so he brought that element in to Soze's backstory when he was writing this film.
Right.
Cool.
Okay, that's insane. But I don't think that Kevin Spacey, who was Kaiser Soze, I don't think that's something he did. I think that was just something he scared.
It's unclear. It's unclear how much truth.
I don't think we're supposed to know that.
Exactly. Yeah. It's left up to the audience.
I guess the mystery alone is like.
I mean, like what they showed us that the details that he threw into his story were all from that board.
With the big revealing montage.
Yes, which was beautifully done.
Faults. But yeah. but it didn't, you know, like there wasn't really anything about certain other elements, so you were left unsure about how much was fault and how much was true.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
What was I going to say? I don't know. It's gone now.
No, but I mean, yeah, I mean, it was really entertaining. So much happening. Action, drama, which is pretty much a thriller as well. Yep. I mean,
this is one of those movies where, you know, if you know the ending, it sort of spoils it for you.
Yeah.
But it also lends you to repeat performances because you can actually go back and see the little things that you didn't notice before when you didn't know the big reveal about Kevin Spacey's character.
Absolutely.
That really surprised me how he was able to take the details from, like, you know, from that agent's office.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That was, you know, all that stuff posted on, like,
you can, and there's actually a shot at the beginning I was noticing where you can actually see him looking around the room gathering the details.
Mm-hmm.
It actually focuses, and even when he got the cup of coffee, you can actually see him looking up at the agent's coffee where the words Kobayashi was written, which he would later use as a name.
Oh, really?
Oil. Yeah, it actually, several times, you can actually see him looking, doing that.
And yeah, also, I don't know.
And there's also other little things that you'd have to sort of kind of have to work for in order.
There's some foreshadowing happening, right? Yeah. Where I remember in the beginning where you see Kaiser Soze, where he's you know about to kill Gabriel Byrne's character. He does this thing with the lighter. Well, he turns on the lighter.
Yeah.
And you see Kevin Spacey as the cripple character. Holding a lighter, but he fumbles it, you know, mm-hmm. he falls down. And then that, you know, it's a little thing like that, but it was a little foreshadowing as to, like,
yep.
maybe that's Kaiser Soze, you know?
Yeah. But then at the very end, you see him getting in the car, and he's just immediately able to hit the lighter. And then you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Right.
And there's also a really great hidden foreshadowing that maybe a lot of people don't know is, When the five criminals first get, you know, they meet up in the lineup and they're being held in the holding cell,
mm-hmm.
and they first start talking to each other and they're revealing who everyone is. Kevin Spacey's character is Roger Kent,
mm-hmm.
Whose nickname is Verbal, that everyone calls him. They call him Verbal Kent, and he actually explains in the scene that he's called Verbal because everyone says that he talks too much, and that's interesting, and that's a foreshadowing because. The name Soze, Christopher McQuarrie got from a English-Turkish translation book, where the word Soze comes from a phrase that means talks too much. Oh. So he's actually telling you straight out,
yeah.
I am Kaiser Soze.
That's funny.
Holy shit! Like he knows that that particular agent isn't smart enough to figure him out. So he's sort of playing with him in a
exactly.
way.
He plays with him.
Oh, he's totally playing with that guy, but this is, he's saying this to the other guys in the holding cell.
Yeah, yeah, to the other, well, you know, he's saying it to the other guys in the cell, but he's also telling you, the audience.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
Right, the audience as well.
I am Kaiser Soze.
Like, no one's going to know what Soze means, you know?
Exactly, unless you look it up what Soze means, you're not going to know.
Right, exactly.
It's just one of those little hidden details that it just sells it once you find those hidden references that you just miss.
And I will admit to zoning out a bit in the middle.
I can agree with that. You know, there probably was a few too many heists going on until the final.
I found the flashing back and forth a little bit confusing. I'm sure a second viewing would make it a lot clearer now that I knew what was going on, but. At first, you know, I didn't know.
It is a very complex movie.
Yeah.
And it is a movie that you have to pay attention to.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, you're just not going to get everything.
Yeah.
And even if you did, you're not going to get everything the first time.
Mm-hmm.
There was one particular scene was when, after they did the lineup, they were in a holding cell all of them together.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that scene took a little too long.
There was a lot of setup happening in that scene.
Yeah.
I guess was important, so...
I guess, but I mean, I didn't really listen to much of it.
They were whispering a lot, too, so that was hard to follow.
So, but
it didn't help that Benicio del Toro was went intentionally incoherent a lot of the time.
Seriously, what was he on?
Well, no.
The
interesting thing was, is like, he knew that his character was getting killed off. And so he knew his character didn't matter to the whole movie.
Right.
He just like, you know what? I'm just going to play this up. And then at one point, you know, you really can't understand what he's saying. And the guy who plays Dean Keaton,
mm-hmm.
Whatever his name, Gabriel Byrne.
Yeah.
He actually suggested to Bryan Singer, if the audience can't understand, if he doesn't matter, then just then you should let the audience in on that. You don't really need to know what he's saying.
That's funny.
Is why they included Kevin Pollak's line at one point. What is he saying? What are you saying?
Yeah.
What is he saying? Like, whatever. We're just going to laugh at what
you're
saying.
You're not giving any pertinent information.
Yeah, he plays important role whatsoever, and he just plays it up.
Yeah.
And he just hams every scene he's in.
He's important in the story so that once Kaiser Soze kills off that character, it intimidates the other characters.
He's important at the motivation, but his character.
Other than that, he doesn't really give a shit.
He doesn't really play into the
movie
itself.
Yeah. And one thing I remember seeing, once I saw the interrogation scene, I remember seeing something online a while ago that the reason they were laughing so much in that scene was because Benicio del Toro kept farting really loudly during the take. And so the laugh you see is real. It's them laughing at him farting constantly.
They were actually laughing so much that Bryan Singer had to get on to them because they were just wasting too much time laughing. And yet they still were cracking each other up. They were saying that Benicio del Toro and Kevin Pollak were the big jokesters, and they were just cracking everyone up. And they were actually playing a game of trying to get Gabriel Bryan, who's this very serious actor, to crack up. That was their goal. And it got so bad that eventually they could not get a serious take, so they just included the laughing in as a way to show them bonding.
Sense. Yeah.
As friends or as whatever.
Right. Like it kind of shows they've known each other before.
So
that made sense. I thought.
So it was not intentional, but it helped the film.
It really did.
It's one of those happy accidents.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. It worked.
Another cool thing that I found out last night while I was looking up the movies, The Usual Suspects got its name from a line in Casablanca.
Yep.
Round up the usual suspects.
Yep.
At the very end of Casablanca, Rick shoots the German head of police or army, whatever his name was.
Strauss.
And Louis, the cop, says to the other lower cops, says, what's his face? He's just been shot. And there's this pause, and you think he's going to turn in Rick. And he goes, round up the usual suspects.
Yeah. He actually says that at the beginning of the
film. He does, which makes the payoff great for the end of the movie. But I just thought that was funny, because we didn't plan that.
Nope.
No.
But it seems there's always some kind of connection between two or more movies every week.
I know.
We should try to keep that going, but I don't want to force it.
No, of course.
No jinxing.
Yeah. Cool. Oh,
very good. Yeah. So lots of interesting discussions came up.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think this was a successful episode.
I hope we do this again soon, because I got other movies that we can...
I think we could really do this pretty often.
Yeah,
it would be cool.
Or maybe within genres we could try.
We could do that.
Absolutely.
But
because I've already started making a list of other movies to suggest.
Oh, good.
Must-see cinemas.
Oh man, I gotta do the same thing. I'd like to do it again, actually.
Yeah. Oh, Stephen, and I guess, and Pedro, I don't know if you've seen it as much. What were yes. your impressions of Casablanca since you had only seen the references to it in Overdrawn at the Memory Bank, the Mystery Science Theater episode?
Okay, I thought...
It certainly explains a lot about that movie.
Yes.
Yeah, there was one thing I thought that was really... I thought I was going to see more of Peter Lorre in Casablanca.
Yeah, he's pretty much a plot device.
Yeah, and he gets... He's only like, what, one scene, maybe two?
Well, he's the one that has the papers.
Yeah.
But every time I see some, like some sort of, like, a comedy skit or whatever, like,
reference to the movie, he's always in it.
Oh, yeah, because he's such a character. He's such a character actor.
Yeah.
He stands out in whatever he does.
Right.
Like, but you despise me, like, don't you? That's a famous line.
Just he was there, like, for, like, 5 minutes.
Yeah, he really wasn't in it that long.
It really was.
But everything you see, like, in every reference, it's like he's part of that Casablanca
reference. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And, I was really hoping to see more of it, too.
Now that you've seen this, I urge you to check out Carrot Blanca. WB did a Looney Tunes spoof on Casablanca.
Oh, I did see that.
Okay, Stephen, look that up. It's short.
I can't remember.
It's called Carrot Blanca, and it's basically all of the main Warner Brothers Looney Tunes acting out a Casablanca spoof. It's pretty funny.
I have probably seen it before, but I will look it up again.
Okay, yeah, it's pretty funny.
It's beautifully
animated. But they have... I can't remember if it's a Looney Tunes character or it's just a caricature of Peter Lorre.
I thought it was Tweety. Bird,
Tweety, that's right. It is Tweety, but he does this really bad Peter Lorre impression where he just keeps going, "You despise me, don't you?"
Yeah, it's Tweety doing Peter Lorre.
There you go. Yeah, I couldn't remember. It's been a while. I'll have to watch it myself.
Yeah.
But I can totally understand not enjoying that episode of MST3K if you hadn't seen Casablanca, because so much of the plot requires you to understand the references of what's going on.
Also, at the movie, I was like, when is Raul Julia going to show up?
Of course. Because, I mean, come on.
And Fester.
And I am Interface.
This movie hurts.
Mom, my nuts.
Mom, my nuts.
Seeing Casablanca really explains a lot about that movie.
Yeah, it doesn't help. It doesn't make it a better movie, but
it really doesn't.
I mean, they're copying Casablanca.
Well, as they say in that episode, never put a good movie in the middle of your crappy movie.
sage advice.
Yes. And on that note, I think we will end the episode tonight, and we will see you all next month with another episode of the Triple Feature Podcast. Leave a comment on our blog or Facebook page letting us know what some of your favorite movies are or what your impressions of any of the three movies we talked about this week was, and we will go from there. Like us on Facebook, Triple Feature Podcast. And you can find us online at triplefeaturepodcast.wordpress.com. Thank you, and good night.
He's looking at you, kid.
I better get more pudding.
The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.